From KPFK in Los Angeles, California, Valley Free Radio in Florence, and WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, WNUC in Detroit, and BikeTalk.org worldwide, this is Bike Talk.
Bike Talk.
Welcome to Bike Talk. I'm Taylor Nichols.
I'm Anne-Marie Drolet.
I'm Nick Richard.
Hey, Nick. Hey, Anne-Marie.
Hello.
Hey, Taylor.
I broke a wheel. I need a new wheel.
Oh, yeah.
Anne-Marie, can you help me out?
You know, I'm okay at fixing wheels, but I do work with a lot of mechanics, so I'm sure I could help you out.
Yeah, I don't need to fix it. I don't need to true it. I got a whole new rim. I need a whole new wheel built. I have these really sweet high flange hubs, and it's a 36-spoke wheel. So it's kind of an old school wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been looking for a couple of weeks to find a good rim to make it, but now I need to build the wheel. And I think that's above my pay grade.
Yeah, don't worry. We can figure something out.
All right.
That's not the answer I was looking for.
What, you wanted Anne-Marie to personally build your wheel?
For free.
$3.99.
No, you can't build a wheel for free. Building a wheel is a real technical skill. I do four crosses with the spokes, and it's, you know, makes the wheel really strong with the high flange hub. So it's it's really great.
Sounds like you know how to do it.
No.
Just, you know, YouTube video. You got it.
Yeah. I think it's harder than it looks.
Yeah. It's a very technical skill for sure. Yeah. All that's right. Why I'm okay at it.
Would you say it's an art?
Totally.
Yeah. I would say, yeah.
I think all bicycle maintenance is an art. You know, getting the derailleur just right is an art. I think it all is.
Yeah.
Getting the seat height is an art.
Requires finesse.
Isn't there a book, Zen and the Art of Bicycle Maintenance?
Yeah.
It started with motorcycle.
Yeah, close enough.
Well, I spent last week down at the California Bicycle Summit in San Diego. And for people who don't know, it's where all of the bike advocates, all of the bike lovers kind of come together for a few days. And it was really inspiring for me. I met a lot of people. I saw some people that I knew. Kendra Ramsey, who is the executive director of Cal Bike and is responsible for sponsoring and hosting the summit, was down there, and I got a chance to talk to her.
Cool.
So I'm here now with Kendra Ramsey, and Kendra is the executive director of Cal Bike. She's the big boss, and she's new on the job. You've been on the job for how long?
About 7-8 months.
And so tell me how the summit's going so far.
So the summit's been great, honestly. We have almost 300 folks between the 2 days, and we've just been having so many great conversations about all the different things about biking and walking and taking transit and all the ways they interconnect, making our streets safer, making them more joyful.
Right.
We just heard from a great group of artists that are also folks that ride bikes and are building community, and it's just... We have a lot of work to do, but we're really excited to do it.
Yeah, it's really nice to be here. And like you said, be with so many like-minded people. And I was just talking with someone earlier, and they were saying that it's inspiring them to kind of keep going, because it is. It's just an uphill battle. What are the biggest hurdles that you've had sort of in front of you in your 7 months on the job?
You know, I think the hurdle everyone has is funding.
Right.
Whether that's funding for any of our individual organizations or funding at the local and state level to build infrastructure.
Right.
We all need to put our money where
our mouth is.
Yeah. Right. You know, our state agencies talk about climate change.
Right.
They talk about our goals, but we need... The highway system was not built without an intention and the investment that went along with it. And so we need to do the same thing to shift trips to walking and biking. The people that are out there that are supportive of biking and walking, please support your local and your statewide organizations.
Right.
We have a big group of them here today that work at the local level, Cal Bike at the state level. Like, we can all use everyone's support. And so government funding, individual funding, you know, funding's a big challenge.
Funding.
Yes.
What's your takeaway from the week?
You know, I think that there are a lot of people with a lot of great ideas. And one of the great things about maybe it's our post-pandemic, our use of the internet and social media, is people are connecting. You know, there are a lot of more traditional organizations like Cal Bike that are, you know, we're 501c3s, we're nonprofits. But we also have folks like the Slow Streets Movement in San Francisco that are sort of grassroots block captains. I think they call themselves the mayors of their street.
Yeah, the mayor of their street. I love that.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of different ways. There's a lot of different ways that bike advocacy and the bike community looks today. And it's just really exciting to see all of those different ways coming together here so we can talk about moving the work forward.
Right. I felt that it was a fairly diverse crowd here today also. Are you seeing different groups of people join the movement?
We are. And I know CalBike has made a concerted effort over the past decade to expand the way we're thinking about bicycling.
Right.
You know, myself, I have never identified as a, you know, quote, cyclist.
Right.
I was someone who rode a bike for transportation from growing up in a car-free household.
Oh, wow.
Because we were low income.
Right.
To being an adult bike commuter.
Right.
I never had a spandex jersey until maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And so, you know, biking looks at different ways for a lot of different people. My main consideration right now personally is I have a 16-month-old that I'm about to get on my bike.
Beautiful.
And so, you know, it looks a lot of different ways, and we are really trying to talk intentionally to folks doing different things, hear what challenges they're facing, and see how we can come up with policy solutions.
Right. How do you see it going forward?
You know, the panel you just saw, I think that's part of the solution. We have, you know, what mostly appeared to me to be younger folks.
Yeah, totally younger,
Who are...
I mean, everyone's younger than me,
well,
but...
who are getting together, and they're bringing the joy of bicycling
right.
and, you know, really talking about how to get where they need to go safely. And I think that understanding how different people are using bicycling as a tool, how different people are talking to each other, I think that's the future.
Right. Kendra Ramsey, thanks a lot for sponsoring the summit.
Yeah, thanks for being here, and thanks for doing what you do as well.
So that was Kendra Ramsey, the executive director of CalBike and the one responsible for the Bike Summit. And one of the great things about the summit was bringing people together and inspiring each other. But as we're learning, not everybody in the movement feels exactly the same about lots of issues that we're dealing with, whether it be how to deal with harassing drivers or vehicular cycling. So I spoke with a vehicular cyclist, Jim Barras. I'm here with Jim Barras, who is an LCI instructor. Jim, what brings you to the summit?
Actually, overall, to get reinvigorated. Hanging out with a bunch of like-minded folks, learning what they're doing, getting inspired, getting some ideas for
right.
things to do, and also spreading my own point of view.
Which is?
There's a controversy among advocates.
We've talked about this before, I think.
Which is overstated. People who feel that the only way to promote bicycling is to change the infrastructure.
Right.
And certainly there's roads are built for cars, and so
right.
that's important. And others of us who think that behavior and skill and ability added to a person will be able to help them ride more safely, more often, to more places. And both things need to happen.
Both things,
some
right.
background in both. But there doesn't need to be the controversy. We all can work together to make all the things happen.
I think why there is controversy is a lot of people feel that back in the 70s and 80s when John Forrester was kind of running the LCI concept, that they actually fought against building bicycle infrastructure. Is that true or not?
No. John Forrester was in favor of bike paths that provided, especially separate from the roadway facilities. One of the famous things he's known for, he lived in Palo Alto for a while.
Right.
Palo Alto tried to turn their sidewalks into bike paths. So he got out on his bike and rode at the speed he normally rides on the road,
right.
on the sidewalk, and almost got killed because of the crosses and the intersections.
Sure.
And he pointed out that many of the efforts to get bicyclists out of traffic, some are pushed by the motorists who
right.
don't want them in the way, didn't really provide a better environment. So, for instance, he was happy to have bike paths along rivers, along freeways, especially where there's no intersections.
Right.
But he gets bad mouth for saying that separate facilities are always better.
Right.
It was a misstatement.
Right. Well, I don't know if you remember, but I got my LCI from you in a class that we did in Los Angeles maybe 10, 15 years ago, something like that. And it did change the way I ride my bike, and I feel like I'm a much safer rider. That said, I feel like so much of the infrastructure that we're building is built for me, meaning that it's not built for women with children or people in cargo bikes to ride to the store. So we do need both. We need separated bicycle infrastructure, and we need to train people who are biking how to bike safely when there is no infrastructure.
Yes, in order to address the fears that people have with riding in traffic, getting hit from behind, having a separated facility in some manner, addresses their fears, and at least between intersections makes a relatively safe place to ride.
Yeah.
But when it's crowded or along Highway 101, when it's full of sand
right.
or beachgoers,
right.
we want to be able to use the road.
Use the road also. That's what happens in New York City, of course. They're building all the bike lanes. But if you really want to move, you got to get into traffic.
And that's a problem when we're trying to provide for all ages and all abilities, which I think is nuts because infants don't bike.
Well, but they do bike with their parents.
Then their parents know how to use that facility.
Yeah, I think we might differ on that a little bit, but agree to disagree.
Great. But everybody has a gradient of skill, ability, and interest in riding, especially in an urban environment where there are some very challenging spaces.
Yeah.
And those very challenging spaces need to be fixed. One way to fix them is grade separation
right.
or providing an alternative space. Putting a cycle track in between and then having the cycle track drop at an intersection and expecting people to know
that's
what
difficult.
To do, is if you don't have traffic signal separation
right.
or grade separation. In the short run, if I want to help people ride more often, more places, they need to know how to use the roadway.
Right. I agree with that.
Deal with traffic.
Yeah.
And that's not for infants.
Yeah.
It's not for children. It's not for everybody. I fully believe that.
Yeah.
So if we can move the infrastructure towards more accommodating, that's good. When is that going to happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. Now. Right. Well, that's a good argument. Jim, thanks very much for training me, and thanks for coming on Bike Talk.
My pleasure, really.
I do think that Jim has a good point. Having more cyclists on the road can make things safer for cyclists and can create a critical mass that leads to more bike infrastructure being built.
Right, because we need the bike infrastructure so that everybody can ride,
mm-hmm.
but everybody, when they are on a street that doesn't have the infrastructure, needs to know how to ride safely in traffic. And I think that brings up the point that, you know, we all really know you disagree with me.
I'm thinking about it.
Well, I was going to say, I think that brings up the point that we have more in common than we do apart. And it's normal for any movement to have different factions that don't agree on every aspect of moving forward. You know, there has been a problem in Los Angeles with a couple of different bike organizations having different issues about how we move forward with a ballot measure. But ultimately, we came together and passed HLA. And I think the same is true in San Diego and in Western Massachusetts. And in Detroit, any city where there's a movement, you're going to sometimes have people that have different opinions about how to move forward. But ultimately, we're all on the same side. We want safe streets for everybody.
The criticism of vehicular cyclists has been that they don't want safe streets for everybody. But Jim seems to be integrating the two sides.
Right. Exactly. Thank you, Nick, for clarifying that. Well, next, I spoke with someone who works for government and got to talk briefly with them about their role in this movement.
I'm here with Emma Melanet of Caltrans. And what's a Caltrans person doing at a bike summit?
So I am with the ATRC, which is the Active Transportation Resource Center, and we are a project funded through the ATP, which is the Active Transportation Grant Program.
Okay. And so what are you doing at the bike summit?
Okay, so we...
Because I always feel like Caltrans is kind of anti-bike. Is that fair to say or not?
Oh, absolutely not. We're
here okay,
to
good.
Change up the narrative. With the ATRC, we provide technical assistance to disadvantaged communities, tribal communities, small rural and urban, and we're actually developing a lot of tools and resources for communities to implement bike infrastructure, non-infrastructure, which is education encouragement.
Right, both important.
Right, so things like safe routes to school,
yeah.
You know, how to properly fit a helmet, train the trainer, crossing guard trainings. We have an interagency agreement with CDPH. So
what's your budget, do you think, at Caltrans compared to the automobile budget?
It just recently got cut from Governor Noose.
I'm glad you said that.
What we're working on right now is we're getting a lot of dating and reporting tools to convey the importance and the impacts of these programs that the ATP is funding.
Great.
So we can get more money for the program.
Great. I stand corrected that Caltrans is bike positive.
We are absolutely bike positive. We're doing big things.
Great. Emma, thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And you're a sponsor for the summit.
And they're a sponsor for the summit.
That's right.
There we go.
That's right. Caltrans cares.
I'm here with Laura. I love your bike.
Thank you.
And you are a bike mechanic. We've met a couple of times working on bikes in Culver City with Jim Shanman.
That's right.
What are you doing down here at the Bike Summit?
I'm here at the Bike Summit trying to infiltrate in the bike legislative advocacy, trying to network with bike-minded people like me.
Oh, I'm so glad that we talked.
Definitely. It's nice to run into.
I was digging your bike.
Thank
what
you.
What kind of bike is it?
It's a Colnago. It's a steel frame, in the 80s steel frame, which I've been, you know, playing with it here and there. I made it into a cargo bike when I lived in New York.
So I love the chrome lugs.
Yeah, that's the most popular thing about it. Everybody just seems to get attracted and pulled in by the steel fork.
Yeah, for sure.
It's
beautiful.
Thank you.
What's your takeaway from the summit here?
That there's a lot of bike enthusiasts and there's a lot of things that we can do to make the infrastructure better for us, for reducing the loss of life, definitely, and just be more active and healthy.
Right, right. Laura, thanks a lot.
Of course. Nice to see you, Taylor.
Nice to see you.
All right.
Well, as much fun as biking is and being on a cool bike and being out on the street, sometimes there's a lot of harassment. Nick, you saw something online, no?
Yeah, one of our co-hosts who covered for Anne-Marie or Lindsay named Caro has a handle, Mobility for Who, and she posted a video that she recorded, I guess, with her helmet cam, and it has one driver after another threatening to physically assault her. I don't know what she's doing. I can't imagine that, like, she's deserving.
She's riding her bike in public. I mean, how dare she?
She's taking up space,
exactly.
How would you even get that many people threatening to physically assault you if you tried?
Well, you know, later in the show, we talk with Kathy Tuttle and Kate Bartlett, and they talk about how riding on the road is different for women than it is for men. So maybe we're closed off to it a little bit, Nick.
Yeah, definitely. Feel my gender when I'm out cycling. I mean, I feel it everywhere, but it's definitely sometimes I'm forced to feel it, you know, the whistles or catcalls or gendered insults. I've mentioned it before, like you're a bitch and you're a slut and things like that. Yeah, I really feel it.
We have a guest joining us, Madeline Bonsma Fisher, who has been on the show many times. She's a cycling researcher from Toronto. Welcome back to Bike Talk. And this is something that you know about also. I wonder if you could give us some insight from your point of view.
Yeah, I became a researcher focused on cycling because I biked around a lot and I just became very passionate about that experience. And as we were talking about this, I was remembering that once someone pulled up beside me at a stop sign and screamed out the window that I deserved to get squashed. Those were the exact words. And like, that's such an extreme thing to say to somebody. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't imagine walking down the street and just looking over at somebody walking down the street and saying something like that. So there's something about those interactions on the road that are just so extreme.
And awful, I might add. If this kind of vitriol was aimed at you in the grocery store, it wouldn't be tolerated. The police would come. But for some reason, we allow it on the road. Is it just being behind the wheel of a car that makes people do that? What is it, do you think?
Most of us have experiences of driving, right? And can think about how that feels. And I know for me, it feels different when I'm driving. Like even the exact same trip at the same time of day, if I'm driving, I feel both impatient for waiting and also anxious for making other people wait. And it's just kind of a whole awful mixture.
I was looking on a Reddit forum. Somebody posted, how do I stop yelling back when people in cars yell at me? They got all these reactions. Somebody said, react in a different way, a friendly wave, act like a mime trapped in a box, sing a song. It's going to confuse the driver more than anything else. Might be fun. Someone else said, I usually scream, I love you, and blow a kiss. And somebody said, say, thanks, I got it for my birthday. Like you misunderstood what they were saying. So there's a whole category of responses where you try to give back something positive.
Or just de-escalate, right? Make it not giving that energy back.
Yeah, because they expect you to get mad. And I feel like people want you to get mad sometimes. So I feel like it is better to not respond angrily.
But, you know, that is so hard sometimes because
yeah, it is.
Your first response is you know, fear and excitement and all of these things come up, and it's just so easy to yell. There was no reason for them to yell at you. They scared the living daylights out of you. And so oftentimes it's easy to have your first reaction be anger.
I think it's so interesting that you mentioned fear in that interaction, because I don't think drivers feel fear when they're yelling at somebody biking on the street. I think, yeah, you know, it's not coming from a place of fear, but then when you feel afraid, you respond in anger. That's very natural. But then I often find if I did respond that way, if I was shouting back at somebody from my bike, then after the interaction is over, I'm just shaking because I'm just scared. That's the main thing.
Do you think there's an analogy to be made between like being in a car and being on social media where you say things you wouldn't say in real life?
Yeah, I feel like there's some anonymity that people feel because they're in this box. You know, it's a very individualistic space and they feel like they're entitled to not be slowed down or inconvenienced. You know, and nothing's going to happen because they're just in their little space protected from the world.
Yeah, right. And the consequences of your actions are gone before you even think about it.
Yeah, because they have speed on their side. Yeah, you know, unless they
and
hit a
power,
red light.
Right. It was interesting in the video that Carl posted, she had interactions with drivers, which were all negative. And then she had interactions with pedestrians and other cyclists that were categorically all positive. It was really interesting.
Of course, there may have been some editing.
Well, true.
But yeah, I just can't believe, I mean, that there was that many people threatening to beat her up.
I imagine what she was doing was just calling them out. And people don't like it when you do that. And then they oftentimes threaten you and they get really angry, you know? Right. So I imagine that's what was happening.
I don't use a helmet cam. Madeline, do you use a helmet cam?
I have one, but I'm too absent-minded to remember to turn it on. So basically, no.
Well, that's the other advice that a lot of people give. Be positive, but also helmet cam. That's one of the top suggestions.
Anne-Marie, do you use one or not?
No, I've actually looked into getting one. I don't really want more surveillance everywhere.
Right.
But it can be a really helpful tool to prevent people from escalating a situation.
There was a guy in a video. She said, "You're on camera. What did you say you wanted to do?" And he said, "Oh, I wanted to do this thing, but I don't want to do it anymore."
Yeah.
I have heard people say that a really good way to combat that is to pull your phone out and either pretend like you're taking video or just go ahead and take video so that you're getting their license plates, the make of their car, and their vitriol aimed at someone else out in public.
I find that when I take my phone out, it seems to escalate the situation. I photograph people parked in bike lanes a lot, and I usually do nothing. I'm just doing it to be like, hey, I saw that. But recently I had it happen where I took a video of a delivery truck that was parked in a contraflow bike lane. Once they saw me recording, they actually drove towards me with the truck. So that seemed like very scary.
What?
Wow. Madeline, do you think that people in Canada are more polite on the roads than people in the United States?
I haven't biked very much in the United States, so I probably can't say. But I would say that it depends what part of Canada you're in.
Right.
Overall, probably they're not different.
Okay. Well, you're in Toronto, right?
Yeah.
Toronto's like...
It's a big city.
Yeah, it's like America Light, no?
Yeah. I mean, I notice a lot of difference even in different parts of the city. Depends if people are sort of expecting there to be people not in cars. If I go 2 kilometers east, kind of to the outer areas of Toronto, it's all of a sudden people are very different and very hostile to people on bikes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have found that when people close past me or something like that, if I catch them at the next light, which I usually do, I just say to them, "You scared me to death." And that seems to have a way of putting them on their heels and getting them to say, "Oh, hey, I didn't mean to scare you," or something along those lines. Occasionally they shout back at, "Well, you have no right to be on the road," or whatever. It's yeah. It's really hard not to escalate.
Yeah, it is, especially when they don't actually know the law at all. They're just making things up.
Right.
I think one of the best things that you can do is to just really loudly say like a vehicle code that you happen to know that's applicable, or point out something that needs to be pointed out, factual, you know, and have no like personal attacks or, you know, just loudly factual.
I do that sometimes. You know, I'll say, "You're driving in a bike lane," or "You almost turned into me." You know, I'm not calling them a name or anything. I'm just stating what
your
they
fact.
Did.
Yeah, see, I don't think that they care. You know, you say, "You have to give me 3 feet." They don't care. They're in a car. They're driving away.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that they care.
I have had someone apologize before. And I was shocked Yeah, I really didn't expect it. I was like, okay, cool. We're good.
But you're still shedding, right? You're like, okay, thank you. Have a nice day.
Yeah. You're nice. Okay, bye.
What led to the apology?
I think they just knew they were in the wrong, and I wasn't being a jerk about it. I was just like, hey, you were driving in the bike lane. And they were like, sorry.
Do we see a difference between male drivers and female drivers, anybody, or not?
There was one woman in the video.
Yeah.
And there was like five men, but that's really a small sample.
Yeah. I feel like I've gotten an equal amount of extreme anger from women.
Yeah. I do too. Yeah.
So now you have two kids with you, Madeline. Do you bike with them? Is it different now?
I just 2 days ago got a cargo bike that has a car seat for my 3-month-old baby. And I've taken her a few very small rides in the neighborhood. And as I contemplate where I would go, like where I would like to bike with her, I'm like, oh no, there's this one part of that road that I can't go on. So I'm very carefully thinking about what time of day and what route and that kind of thing. So for sure, my risk tolerance is totally different than when I was, you know, a 21-year-old commuter.
Sure. Just like, when you were Anne-Marie Drolet.
So how are you going to respond to a driver who's rude on the road now?
Well, that fear response is much more elevated. So it's kind of hard to predict. You know, I had a lot of incidents while I was pregnant, which felt similar in terms of the way I felt about it, but people can't tell that I have kids with me when I'm pregnant. So I shouted a lot at people. My 4-year-old son, he'll be in the back of the bike and yelling, hey, stop. Hey, stop. Which is something that I guess he hears me say a lot. Yeah.
He's been taught well.
You know, I raised both of my kids on the back of my bike also, but now I hear that sometimes parents are getting, you know, really negative comments for being out on the road with their children. Mm. Have you experienced any of that?
I haven't, but I imagine it happening. Like, I always wonder, are people going to judge me and think that this is a bad idea? I mean, I get it a lot online. I'll just say that people are like all the time I get comments like, oh, it's irresponsible to bike with kids. I kind of ignore the online version, but I am worried that somebody might say that or think that in real life.
What about some of the studies you've read, Madeline? Does anything relate to why drivers might be angry? Or
there was a really interesting study that I think Caro brought up by Ian Walker in the UK about the idea of modal normativity. I'm paraphrasing a little bit and I might have got details wrong, but basically they had a bunch of statements like it is a bad idea to do X in front of other people. And X was either like idle your car or smoke cigarettes, for instance. And when the statement pertained to kind of an equivalent bad behavior or antisocial behavior in a car, people were much more likely to say that it was acceptable or that it was like not their responsibility to do something about that than if it was about something like smoking cigarettes. So it's just this idea that there's kind of this cultural lack of awareness of the negative impacts of driving. And that's not specifically about, you know, harassment, but I think that probably the same idea applies, that people don't really think about the way that they're threatening somebody with a vehicle is perceived or the harm that can cause.
Yeah, especially if they've never been on the other side and they haven't experienced that. Yeah, that's such a good point about just driving culture is so normalized that people don't even realize the negative impacts that they're having on anyone who's not in a car. People in a car's movement is prioritized in the world, you know, and other people's
isn't. And so it starts to feel like that's your right to have.
Yeah. That. Yeah, exactly. It's like it's their God-given right, or, you know, it's in the Constitution or something.
And I think that's why drivers are so aggressive when you get behind the wheel. You feel like it's your domain. Someone's in your way. You have the right to honk, yell, close pass on them.
Maybe it's like there's a pecking order that people feel and you're like jumping out of line. You know, if you think that you can go in front of me, you're not a car.
Yeah. Yeah. There's power dynamics at play. They have speed that they don't want to lose. I've been in a car and been exasperated that I had to slow down. So I can understand that feeling. I wouldn't threaten someone's life. Yeah. I think when you have that speed on your side and you expect it to not be inhibited, all of a sudden you get super pissed off when you're inconvenienced and you have to slow down.
Driving this $60,000 car.
This modal normativity study by Ian Walker, I'm looking it up now. It uses the term car blindness. Also, you hear windshield bias. A lot of people have experienced that, like police have this. Like if you try to report something that happened, that you were on a bike and you got, you know, somebody sped up to the back of your bike and, you know, made you think they were going to hit you and they did it on purpose. There was a War on Cars episode where Doug Gordon, the host, was almost hit by a car and he slapped the hood. The guy followed him home, said, "Now I know where you live." And when the police came, you know, the guy was still there in front of his house, having threatened him, basically saying, I know where you live because you touched my car." The police said, well, they talked to both of them and they said, "You shouldn't touch people's cars." I don't know. That's just one anecdote.
Wow.
But,
you know, it's funny. A similar thing happened to me where somebody closed past me and I chased her down. I yelled at her and then I filed a police report. And then the police talked to her and they said, "Well, she said that you followed her and yelled at her. So don't do that." And that was kind of the end of it. And then they said, "Oh, the road is actually wide enough for a bike and a car to go side by side." So that was the end of that. And I felt very almost embarrassed and also pretty discouraged.
I bet you felt very protected by them in that moment.
Right.
Felt like less inclined to file police reports.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important that cyclists do file police reports for close calls because we need to keep a record of these things. And the police need to, you know, this is one thing that Jim Pocras often talks about, that lots of times law enforcement doesn't know the law as well as cyclists do, as well as we do. And so we have to keep putting it out there that it's not right that a car can threaten a person on the road. You wouldn't do that in the grocery store. And just because we're on the street, you can't do it there. So I'm glad to hear that you did that. And I would encourage people to continue to do it.
Jim Pocras is our lawyer, in case you haven't been listening. He gives legal advice on our show.
There's another study that is trying to do a full cost accounting of the pros and cons of biking for your health and for your life expectancy. And what they found is that even though you do have some negative impacts from things like air pollution and the risk of accidents and collisions, that on balance, people who bike live longer because of the benefits from exercise and general well-being.
I love that. Madeline Bonsma Fisher, thanks for coming on Bike Talk and sharing your experiences.
We talk a lot about cyclists being seen. Last week, we talked about high-vis, wearing high-vis clothing, and what is the responsibility of the cyclist. But in many cases, I think that's missing the point. Now we want cyclists to be seen and heard. And so we have two guests today, Kathy Tuttle, who is an urban planner and a PhD in urban design. Dr. Kathy Tuttle is on the board of Bike Loud Portland. And she's actually not living in Portland right now. She's living in Utrecht. And I think everybody knows that Utrecht is the Portland of Europe. Is that right, sort of, Kathy?
That's fair. It's the best biking city, I think, in the world.
Great. And our other guest is Kate Bartlett. And Kate Bartlett is on the Women's Cycling Network, and she's from London, joining us from London. Thank you all very much for coming today. I'm really looking forward to talking. But I want to start with this idea of, why is Bike Loud even necessary? Where are we in this world that we need to have organizations that make bikers be seen and heard?
I mean, Bike Loud is, it's a bunch of friendly people, but we find that in order to be heard by the local authorities that are going to make changes to the streets that we have to use for everyday transportation, we have to be loud. We have to speak up and say, public space belongs to all of us, and we have to be a voice for that to happen.
And that's for all people who bike ride.
Absolutely, yes.
Yep. It's even, I don't want to say worse, but it is, it's worse for women and people of marginalized communities, no?
Yes, in a word. So I wrote an article for Momentum magazine, a bicycling magazine.
Right.
And I based it on the survey that I gave in Portland. And the survey was actually developed by Kate's group, the London Cycling Campaign, the women's part of the London Cycling Campaign. And I saw the London survey and I said, I'd like to try this survey out in Portland. And it turns out that women do have an appalling amount of anger directed towards them when they're out biking. And what was amazing is that what we found in Portland and what the London study found was there was similar kinds of anger about women being in public space, particularly women on bicycles. And Kate has a lot to say about it because they gave their survey a year before we gave ours in Portland.
Right. Well, Kate, welcome to Bike Talk. And I wanted you to talk about your survey.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, maybe just a little bit about how the survey came about.
Yeah, please, yes.
I mean, in London, the level of cycling has increased over the last 10, 15 years significantly, which is brilliant. We have 1 million trips being made by bicycle every day in London, which wow. is just under 5% of all trips. That's great. We've had some pretty good quality cycleways, traffic calming mechanisms, good kind of infrastructure at junctions, lots of good things. But what stands out from all of that is that less than 1 in 3 of those journeys being cycled are made by women. And we just really wanted to get behind that and understand what was going on, why more women weren't cycling. And from that, our survey was born, really, to start to understand that. I think when the results came in, we were not surprised to hear that women feel unsafe and uncomfortable cycling in the vicinity of much faster, big vehicles, etc. Right. They feel uncomfortable on streets with a lack of lighting, you know, cycle routes that take them through isolated areas, all stuff that needs to be addressed. But what really hit us, which Kathy was mentioning, was this whole thing about aggression, intimidation, abuse. 93% of the women who responded told us that they had been intimidated by drivers in their cars. 77% said that that had happened once a month to them. Wow. 90% talked about abuse, might be verbal and sometimes actually physical, you know, right. unbelievable, but true. Men getting out of their cars to thump women, shout at them, threaten them. You know, this was not one or two comments. This was over 1,000 women. And as I say, the vast majority of them had had some of these kinds of experiences. So I think that's a pretty good answer to your do we need to be here?
Well, it's an awful answer.
And campaigning.
It's, you know, yeah. As a male and a confident biker, I get hassled also. And I got to tell you, I guess I just didn't think that it's worse for women. For some reason, I'd sort of thought, oh, it must be better for women because they know that it's a woman. And I heard about a study anyways where a biker had put on a blonde wig and cars gave him more space when they passed. And so for some reason, this was new to me and it's really shocking. Kathy, in your article, you say that in the United States, we have so many less women biking than we do men for transportation, but that in Europe, it's more women bike for transportation than do men.
Well, that's certainly true in the Netherlands and actually in some Asian countries as well, Japan in particular. One of the reasons that there are more women biking than men is because there's still this income disparity and the bicycle is a much less expensive sure. mode of transportation. And women also do a fair amount of the caregiving in families, and bicycles are ideally set up for doing that, for trip chaining, that is from going from the school to the grocery store, to the park, to the back to the school. Those kinds of trips are perfectly suited for people on bikes, making those short journeys. The thing about Kate's survey, when we gave it to the London survey, when we gave it in Portland, is we found almost identical kinds of anger towards women on bikes. It was pretty shocking how closely aligned our surveys wow. were. And one of the things that really struck me was when I gave the survey in Portland to a city of 650,000 people, within a week and a half, we had 500 replies from women.
Wow.
The experiences that they had while biking. And part of it, and this is something that Kate and I have been talking about, is the survey includes long, open-ended questions. Mm-hmm. And there was so much emotion that was put into those long answers about the kinds of close passes and the purposeful stalking and the words that were shouted at women and their children while they were on bikes, the threats with guns, the deliberate targeting. I mean, it was just appalling, the mountain of stories that came right. in.
Can I just add, I mean, you mentioned about, Kathy mentioned about women and the kind of more local journeys, the child caring responsibilities. And that was absolutely something that came out in our survey, that what cycle infrastructure there is tends to be about taking people from the outskirts of the city into the centre. And our respondents all said that their local journeys just weren't supported right. and that they very few of them made those local journeys, you know. They tended, if they made journeys, to do the go along the nice cycle infrastructure to take you into the city right. rather than take the kids to school, go to the shops, go to the hospital, the kind of things that are just absolutely everyday trips in the higher cycling countries. And I think that's also, there's this kind of strange pattern amongst low cycling countries and high cycling countries. High cycling countries have high percentages of women, low cycling countries, low percentages of women. Also, low cycling countries, those trips that are cycled are predominantly to work. When you look at the high cycling countries, as Kathy says, it's all sorts of journeys. So there's some very different.
School, right? Yeah. And Kathy, I think the first time we at Bike Talk met you was when you were talking about a bike bus in Portland, and you talked about getting children to school on their bike.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a program that started with a particular school in Portland, Alameda Elementary School, with Coach Sam Balto, but it spread to schools all over Portland because it's such a joyful and community building experience.
Right.
So there are bike buses throughout the city and beyond too.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I think that children need to feel safe on the road, old people, young people. I mean, it's one of the beautiful things about being in Utrecht is, you know, I've explained the survey to my Utrecht friends and they look at me like I'm crazy. I mean, why would somebody purposefully accelerate and intimidate someone on a bicycle? It makes no sense at all here.
And well, yet, partly, if I can answer that, partly because they can in the United States. You know, we have roads that allow them to do that. And maybe you could speak briefly about Utrecht. I know that it's a city in the Netherlands, but that's about all I know. And so I'm not sure if many of our listeners also know that it's the world capital of cycling over Amsterdam. Or maybe you could talk briefly about why you moved from Portland there and what biking in Utrecht is like compared to, say, Los Angeles, London, Portland.
Well, I mean, Portland is one of the better cycling cities in America, but Utrecht is a city of 350,000 people. It's about an hour or 30 some kilometers from Amsterdam. It's in the center of the country. Amsterdam's out on the west coast of the country of Netherlands. And it is wonderful. I mean, the entire city is a safe place to bike. There are no places where I would not feel safe biking with a child. There are no places that I would feel unsafe at night. It's simply a place that is designed for what it has, which is 45% of all trips are made by bike, and most of the rest are made by walking or by transit. Everybody owns a car. People own their cars and they use them on the weekends to go camping or visit their family or visit friends. But during the week, people bike.
Right. And that saves a lot of money, I bet, too.
It does. And it also makes it a much quieter, more livable place.
I mean, I think that what Kathy and I have both found is that the kind of the richest part of the survey response was where we gave people a what is it that stops you cycling free format, and that, you know, because I think we just didn't want to guide people down the lines. And I think that was really helpful. And that was where these kind of firsthand accounts of experiences.
Can you share some of those stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think one that comes to mind as a woman cycling with her young child in a cargo bike, and somebody drew up, got out, started telling her that she should be ashamed of herself for putting her child at such risk, that, you know, children did not belong on the road and she should just not be doing this.
Right.
So that was an interesting one in terms of the underlying attitude there. One woman was slapped on the bum while sitting at some traffic lights by a guy leaning out of his car, and endless tales of the kind of following up really close behind someone and then taking the opportunity when they pass, going, you know, one would have to assume deliberately close.
Sure.
So it's a kind of a mixture of stuff, but absolute, you know, horrible threats of violence.
Yeah.
It's pretty extreme.
And, well, I always find whenever anyone does close past me that they are so angry. I'm always shocked at the aggressiveness and the anger of people behind the wheel towards me, towards any cyclist on the street. Now that you've done the surveys and you've gathered the information, what are you doing with the information and what can we do to help alleviate these kinds of problems?
I think this is the first step. I think that the understanding that there is this incredible aggression towards women while they bike is very important for other people who bike, male people who bike, to understand. It's important for women to realize that they're not alone in experiencing this kind of aggression. It's important for politicians and engineers to realize that women have special needs while they're out biking. A lot of work has been done about women using transit. Very little has been done about women and biking, other than, oh, they get, you know, helmet hair and they need a shower after they bike. I mean, that's nothing compared to the kind of intense anger and, you know, women don't belong in public space kind of actions towards women while they're biking. So, you know, we need better lighting. We need more women who are engineers who are planning places for people to bike. We need to actually educate people about the fact that women on bikes, particularly women with children on bikes or older women with bikes, people with special needs on bikes, have special requirements for the kind of bike infrastructure that we have. We know that we have to go beyond sharrows and door zone lanes. Right. We have to actually provide enough space for families to bike. We have to have enough places for people to be protected from the incredible aggression that people have when they're behind the wheel. I mean, of course, I live in Utrecht. I see some angry drivers sometimes, but you're right. Having angry drivers in a place where they can't jump the curb and get to you makes a huge difference as well. It's actual realization that women actually have needs as people who bike. We have needs as road users. And those needs really haven't been addressed at all in either bike planning or in the kind of the research literature to date, too.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that we're talking about it today, because again, before I read your article, I hadn't really thought that much about it. I was so concerned about my own safety that I didn't realize that there are other groups out there that have it worse than I do.
We have set ourselves a target of making sure that all women who want to cycle feel safe to cycle. And what we want to see is that by 2030, equal numbers of men and women making cycle trips. So that's our kind of target. We put together a petition, which we presented to the mayor along with our report. And in that, we really ask for action in three areas. One is acting on physical safety, giving us infrastructure that's safe, looking at social safety, and that tackles the abuse, the aggression, and things like the lighting, put the routes in safe places. And thirdly, providing good local cycle networks. So those are the kind of high levels. But I think the challenge is then, how do we make all of that happen? And, you know, it's not going to be solved just by infrastructure. There is behavioral change that has to be brought about. And there has to be, you know, education. There's a whole combination of factors. I mean, I'd say very directly, what can you do? And I think be an ally in your conversations with politicians, with planners, with your fellow cyclists, with somebody you see behaving inappropriately when you're out on your bike. I think that's, you know, the most important thing any individual can do. If we can make streets safe for women and children, then it's good for everybody.
It's good for everybody, right?
Yeah.
Well, you say in your article that our society tolerates aggressive behavior toward people who ride their bike from people who drive their cars.
Well, this is this motor normativity. I don't know if you've been listening to those. And, you know, it's we forgive so much from cars and car drivers because they're so ubiquitous. They're extensions of us. If you question where a car can be, what kind of space a car can take, where a person can park, you don't question it. I mean, it's just your life. You know, everything is wrapped up into the normalization of having a car everywhere.
Right.
Having a bike just messes with that.
Well, this is a real education in biking loud. So thank you very much, Kate Bartlett from London and Kathy Tuttle from Utrecht, for opening my eyes to this, for doing all the work that you're doing, and for coming on Bike Talk. It was really a pleasure to talk with you and to hear your stories. I'm going to have to go to Utrecht one of these days. I hope you're still there. If I go, I'd love to meet and go for a ride around Utrecht. And I do get to London, Kate, so maybe we'll
let me know.
Bike around London.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Good to talk to you.
Well, May is Bike Month. And so we're going to reach out to some of the communities that have been supporting Bike Talk and that have been on Bike Talk and find out what they're planning for Bike Month. So right now we have from Detroit, Rio Ramsey and Mr. Todd Scott. You guys, welcome to Bike Talk again.
Hey, thanks for having us on.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
Are you on a pedicab right now?
I'm in a parking garage. So I work for Rickshaw Detroit. I start during the NFL draft, and it's a minority-owned, veteran-owned pedicab company in Detroit. And they service downtown. They do weddings and tours. I'm just, you know, trying something different.
Is it an electric pedicab?
No, sir.
Yeah, but some of those guys in the NFL draft are big.
We got quality bikes.
Okay.
Maybe you both can tell us what's going on in Detroit for Bike Month.
I mean, one of the first events of May is the Joe Louis Greenway Ride for Safety event that the Joe Louis Greenway Partnership is hosting along with AAA and a lot of organizations, including the Detroit Greenways Coalition. And they're going to have some bike safety workshops there, some giveaways, some guided bike rides, food and refreshment, music, and more. It should be pretty cool. More towards the middle of the month, May 17th is our what used to be called Bike to Work Day. But since COVID, you know, not many people are necessarily commuting to work, especially on a Friday. So we call it Bike to Everywhere Day. Largely for us, it's just going to be about social media, getting the word out that let's give your car a day off and try a different form of transportation to get to wherever you need to go, whether that's work, school, or just around town. We're still putting that all together, but it's largely going to be a social media campaign to remind people that there are options besides driving. At the end of May, we haven't got all the details yet, but we're working with the Detroit Grand Prix to have a Grand Prix bike ride. We're going to call it the Green Prix. Do a few laps around the course because the course will be closed to not only the public, but also the racing cars, of course. So it'll just be us out there and we'll be able to do a few laps, cross the finish line, and then head back to Eastern Market.
That sounds like a blast.
Yeah, it should be pretty interesting, you know, and I just wrote up a little blurb for them about the history of auto racing and how it came about through bike racing. You know, some of the great bike racers like Louis Chevrolet and Albert Champion and Barney Oldfield were all bike racers before they got into the automotive industry and automotive racing.
I did not know that. Rio, you have anything planned for Bike Month?
I have a bicycle club. Well, I'm the president, Motown Trailblazers. We're hosting our season opener for Cinco de Mayo, May 5th. And we're having our second annual Joe Louis Greenway ride. We're going to showcase some of the newer parts of the Joe Louis Greenway, about 10 to 15 miles ranging. And we're going to go get everybody some tacos. We're going to have a bike giveaway. We're going to have a few other giveaways, a raffle. And we're partnered up with you guys. And we're partnered up with the Joe Louis Greenway Partnership. And it's going to be a blast.
Sounds good, you guys. So that's what's going on in Detroit in Bike Month. Thanks very much.
And now we have Caro Villain, who we mentioned at the beginning of the show. You made it on. Hey, Caro.
Hey, everyone.
You want to take us out with a bike quote, Caro?
Fucking bike. I bike.
If it's more than a block, I'm biking it.
The road may be long, but the memories last forever.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, y'all.
Taylor, you going to say it?
Ride safe.
Hi, this is Stacy with a bike thought. Here in the U.S., February is Black History Month. March is Women's Month. April has Earth Day and is Climate Month. May is Bike Month. Yay! We have these special days and months to focus on something that historically has not had enough attention. Here in the U.S., we have built a world where cars feel like a requirement to function in society. Let's take a moment to imagine a country, a world cured of car blindness, without motor normativity, where traveling outside of a car is the norm and driving is the rare exception. What a wonderful world that would be. This episode of Bike Talk is sponsored by the law offices of Pocras and De Los Reyes, with offices in Los Angeles and Bakersfield and serving all of Southern California.
And that was Bike Talk. If you have a story, a tip, or a topic, head over to biketalk.org and send us a message. Talk again next week.
Push on a pedal, push on a pedal, get ya. Heart started, push on a pedal, push it down and up again. Push on a pedal, push on a pedal, get ya. Heart started, push on a pedal, push it down and up again. Get on your bike, sit on the seat.
Put your feet on the pedal and ride it all around, get on your bike, sit on the seat, put your feet on the pedal and ride it all around
yourself a bike.